and welcome to a new edition of Mercenary Musings Radio, a bi-weekly audio program featuring mining analyst and commodities expert, the mercenary geologist, Mickey Fulp. We are your most trusted source for in-depth analysis and commentary on commodities, mining, and the junior resource sector. And joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, the mercenary geologist himself, Mickey Fulp. Mickey, this is a great time of the year, isn't it? We have NHL playoffs underway, and your favorite sport, baseball, the season kind of warming up now.
Well, this is true, but my hockey team exited in the first round once again, the St. Louis Blues, so I'm really focused now on baseball, and the Cardinals have the best record in baseball, so what else is new?
Yeah, okay, what else is new indeed? Yeah, they've had a great track record in recent years, and with your Blues out, I know that you're now going to be backing my New York Rangers, aren't you?
Why not?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hope they knock out Washington. We've got a slew of elements that we're going to be touching on for this program. Mickey, you suggested numbers 89 through 98 in the periodic table, and we're talking about naturally occurring actinides. Tell us all about them.
Well, you've said it, the naturally occurring actinides. Now, the actinide series, there's actually 15 elements, and it's with similar properties as per the row above in the periodic table, the lanthanides, a.k.a. the rare earth elements, which we've talked about before. Naturally occurring ones, 89 through 98 on the periodic table, there are 10 of those. There are actually five more that have been synthesized. Two of these we've discussed previously, and that would be thorium and uranium. Mm-hmm. So we're going to eliminate those from significant discussion. But these are all radioactive elements, very high density, soft and silvery. And with the exception of thorium at 15 ppm in the crust and uranium at about 3 to 4 ppm, these are all mostly extremely rare to infinitesimal radioactive elements, and that has to do with generally they have very short half-lives.
Right, okay, so they're all radioactive. Also, a neat angle to this, Mickey, is that we're talking about stuff that has not been found through traditional kind of mineral exploration. We're talking about experiments came in the lab first. That's where they were discovered. In other words, we're talking about man-made discoveries versus finding something in nature, correct?
Well, for the most part, with the exceptions of the ones that occur before uranium on the periodic table, and that would include actinium at 89, thorium, mentioned before, at 90, and protactinium at 91, they were known previously because they are decay products of uranium. But the ones, what they called the transuranics, which would be the ones above uranium in the periodic table, those six were all discovered via nuclear experiments and reactions during a time period of, say, around 1940 to 1950. But they were all predicted by Enrico Fermi in 1934. As you said, they were first known synthetically, but since they were discovered, then they have all been found in minute amounts in high-grade uranium ores post-discovery.
Right, and when they're found in such minute amounts, Mickey, does that make their extraction to be that much more complex, that much more difficult?
Well, this is very true because they're radioactive and sometimes fairly highly radioactive. They only occur in nuclear reactors and experiments for the most part. So they are very high cost, and in some instances, they are so extremely rare there would only be a few atoms ever found or acquired. For instance, one of them has something on the order of a gram in the total extraction in, 70 years of nuclear experiments,
right.
A gram total ever extracted.
Thorium and uranium, the most abundant, though, correct?
Oh, most definitely, and really the only ones that occur in any significant amounts in the crust. Plutonium has some occurrences in the crust, but not a whole lot.
Okay, now which of all these elements that we're talking about today, Mickey, are the most important and the most useful in terms of today's applications? What would you say?
Well, first, let's name them, starting with number 89 and going through 98. So we have actinium, thorium, protactinium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, curium, berkelium, and californium. So there's only a couple of those that have any significant uses at all. First of all, actinium, which is a product of decay of uranium. So let me back up and say the ones ahead of uranium in the periodic table have daughter products and decay from uranium. So actinium is used in a neutron source, thermoelectric generators, in satellites and space stations. It also has some minor uses as nuclear medicine. Protactinium is a decay product of uranium, and it is used in very young or relatively young in geologic time for radiometric age dating. So that would be a protactinium to thorium ratio. Neptunium is above uranium in the periodic table, so it actually forms in high-grade uranium ores by neutron capture, and so it is essentially the alchemist wet dream, if you will. You know, there's always been alchemy and the desire to change elements into other elements. Well, this actually happens in nuclear decay and also neutron capture. It has no significant commercial apps. Plutonium, we're going to spend the whole next show talking about plutonium, but right. It obviously has lots of uses in nuclear weapons and some other relatively esoteric applications. The one that is really used is americium. And I'm sure the room you're sitting in your house right now, if you look up on the ceiling, you have a smoke detector. And that smoke detector contains very small, minute amounts, about one-third of a microgram of americium. And so it is now all over the world in very small amounts. So it's also used in as a neutron source and in industrial gauges.
Right. What role does it play, Mickey, in a smoke detector? What does this ingredient do?
So it emits alpha particles. So this emission, when smoke comes in, it actually would be taken up into the smoke detector and block the emission of an alpha particle, which then keeps the circuit from completing and sets off an alarm. So that's basically the way it works. And it is the most useful and... you know, back in the day, I think they used radon, but it's much less radioactive than radon and only emits alpha particles.
Are there any health or research uses at all in this? I know that plutonium, for example, is used in implants in the human body to help power a heart pacemaker. What about some of the other elements?
Well, the only one that I was able to find that has nuclear medicine applications was the aforementioned actinium. Going on up the periodic table, we have curium, first synthesized 1944. It actually has some minor applications for neutron sources for X-ray spectrometers. And all the Mars rovers basically function, the X-ray spectrometer functions because of curium. The most rare one is berkelium. It is the most rare naturally occurring element on the planet, and this is the one where there's been a total of 1 gram produced actually since 1967. And then the final one would be californium, and that is the heaviest of all naturally occurring elements, once again formed by neutron capture in high-grade uranium ores. And it has very minor applications used in nuclear reactor startups and instrumentation as a neutron source.
Okay, and of course, going back to the beginning of this interview, a common thread running throughout this, Mickey, is that the toxicity involved in all of this. So we're talking about material that can be quite harmful. So disposing of it, the waste, that's another issue, isn't it?
Well, it is. These are radioactive elements. For the most part, they have very short half-lives, and so there's only maybe one or two of them that have primordial legacies from the beginning of the universe or the beginning of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot, several of them have relatively medium-term to long-term half-lives, so in the order of a few thousand years, and so those become of concern in nuclear waste. But in a typical spent fuel rod from nuclear reactors, spent nuclear fuel, these are so minor that they don't really enter into the equation for the most part, except they do give some legacy in longer term geologic time.
Mm-hmm.
But like you say, they are very highly toxic. Some of them as toxic as plutonium and cancer-causing, but mm-hmm. probably unless you work unprotected in a nuclear research lab, human beings are not at risk for poisoning or radioactive disease from these elements.
And we're going to be really kind of exploring this a little bit further in depth in our next show in terms of the safe storage and disposal of this type of material. We're going to be going in depth on plutonium next time out.
Well, we are, and we're going to we're going to do a whole show on these things and include plutonium, but as I got into it, we realized that plutonium merits its own show.
Mm-hmm.
And so next time we're going to talk about plutonium, and then the plan right now is then we will devote about half the show to nuclear waste and some of the possible solutions for that problem.
Okay, and we'll do it all over again in a couple of weeks, Mickey. Thanks very much.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Rob.
That's Mickey Fult, the Mercenary Geologist. You can find him on the web at mercenarygeologist.com. And you can always hear Mickey's latest opinion exclusively on mercenarygeologist.fm and kitco.com. I'm Robert Graham at Mercenary Musings Radio. Thanks for listening.